Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Regina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to this workshop today. It's addressing the LGBTQI plus health disparities gap. And today's program is supported by GlaxoSmithKline. I really want to thank them for their support to this program. Now, we have on the program today over 350 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Algeria, Bahrain, Canada, Ghana, Malawi, Peru, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call as well. And we're delighted to have all of you on this program today. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mandy Pratt Chapman. And Dr. Pratt Chapman is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, School of Medicine and Health Sciences, Associate Professor, Department of Prevention and Community Health, Milken Institute School of Public Health, Associate Director, Community Outreach and Engagement, GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences. And Dr. Pratt Chapman will be addressing an overview of cancer and the LGBTQI plus community, including HIV and HPV, the LGBTQI plus community's disproportionate cancer burden and health disparities gap. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pratt Chapman.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here with this very distinguished group of people. We have quite a row of talent here on the call today. I just wanted to speak at a high level so that we have time for questions and answers at the end. But when we're thinking about cancer disparities in the queer population or the LGBTQI plus population, what we're really talking about is disproportionate kind of social determinants of health that affect our health outcomes because of our lived experiences. So much like racial and ethnic minorities, others who have documented disparities, it's the stress that comes from having differences in economic stability, differences in physical environment, differences in education, family support, healthcare system comfort, access, and affirming care that lead to heightened distress, heightened stress, internalized kind of prejudice, and external discrimination, differential social support. Historically, we have in our community, safe spaces have been bars, and so given that landscape, we have higher rates of tobacco use and alcohol use. That were really very intentional in terms of marketing from tobacco and from alcohol industries, because that's where we were able to kind of connect and have some safe space. But that in turn puts our body at greater stress to have, you know, we all have these circulating cells in our bodies that if they're aberrant, are supposed to die, and if our immune system is compromised because of stress hormones, then those abnormal cells are more likely to survive and replicate. So I was asked also to talk briefly about HIV and HPV in relation to cancer, and it's really important to note that these are very separate conditions, HIV, and they are completely different diseases. However, if someone is HIV positive, because of a weakened immune system, they're more likely to get an HPV infection, and it can be harder for HPV to clear. The vast majority of people have some level of HPV infection or exposure, but it can it can kind of show up and disappear and show up and disappear. And if it isn't able to clear up within your system because your immune system is weakened, then you're at greater risk for HPV-related cancers, which include cervical cancers, penile cancers, head and neck cancers. So we have a very special, I think, opportunity in the queer community to make sure that our youth and our young adults are vaccinated with the HPV vaccine so that we have greater protection and can reduce our disproportionate risk in on that front over time. So I am, again, I'm going to kind of pause because we have so many panelists and take questions at the end. I will just also just share that last year, about this time, I published an article where I was looking at LGBTQI experiences in the, across the cancer continuum, and specifically, I did a deeper dive into transgender care and radiation oncology and radiology, and found in talking with physicians so many gaps in terms of training, in terms of confidence, and even some folks who, I remember this one person said, you know, because I'm a very out gay physician, everyone thinks I'm the person that knows how to care for transgender patients, but we, but that person didn't really have any training and felt ill-equipped to be able to provide affirming care. So I think we just have a long way to go in terms of reducing stigma, both internally, interpersonally, working on dismantling the structural bias that's embedded in our systems from a very specific vantage point of a heteronormative vantage point, and that we have a long way to go and a lot of collaborative opportunities to help improve training, improve data collection so that we can really diagnose these disparities in our data, in our research studies, and then identify positive interventions that improve the resiliency of our communities. So I will stop there, and I'm happy to take questions, but you have a number of very expert colleagues on this call, and I want to be sure they have their time.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Pat Chapman. Wonderful presentation, and also you did set the tone for today's program. You're the first speaker, and you kind of set the stage for today's program, and so thank you for doing that. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kelly Haviland. Dr. Haviland is a dance practice provider manager, professional development advanced practice providers, LGBTQI plus clinical consultant, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Haviland will be addressing barriers to healthcare access, including discrimination and mistrust of healthcare providers, and healthcare screening, palliative, and supportive care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Haviland.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me. And thank you, Dr. Pat Chapman, for setting the stage perfectly for this discussion today. I'll get right to it. I think as a result of that stress that Dr. Pat Chapman had mentioned, there are a variety of reasons that our LGBTQI plus populations are hesitant to present to healthcare providers for care. Unfortunately, healthcare providers don't receive enough medical or any medical information in many cases about the disparities in these populations, in our populations, and the same for the advanced practice providers, nursing colleagues. So there is a pretty large gap in understanding of what these actual disparities are, why they occur, and as Dr. Pat Chapman alluded to, there is a lack of collection of data points, including sexual orientation, gender identity. So oftentimes our our patient populations are not interested in disclosing sexual orientation or gender identity as a result of fear, prior discrimination, unwelcoming environments when one walks into a clinic, hospital, institution to receive care. What are we seeing? What are, when we in our physical environment? what visual cues do we see? Do we see prominent non-discrimination non-discrimination policies? What are we seeing that are affirming to our sexual orientation or gender identity status? And so when we have, when there is a lack of provision of those prominent, welcoming, affirming areas, that means that we really don't feel as welcome, and so are less likely to talk about what our own experiences are, to share about our sexual orientation or gender identity. And these are really extremely important factors. We do know that in end-of-life care specifically, there is a lack of provision of advanced directives. There's a fear of disclosure of sexual orientation and gender identity at the end of life or when attempting to receive care in long-term care settings. And there's been more of a movement to go back into the closet for fear of not receiving adequate pain control, not receiving adequate care, not receiving adequate, all symptom management that we need as we progress through life. And we also know that advanced directives, things like healthcare proxy forms, are not routinely offered to sexual and gender minoritized persons. And we know that there are different types of family structures, which include close friends, relatives in some instances, but don't necessarily include a next of kin. And unfortunately, adequate information isn't always provided about medical decision making when one becomes, or if one becomes incapacitated. There's also things like disenfranchised grief that occurs when one's loved one dies, and that the remaining partner is left and not recognized as who they really are, that significant person in their lives. So doesn't have the ability to grieve and be recognized in their grief in ways that are really affirming. And then just lastly, there's a variety. There's so much to talk about on this topic, but for our institution, we do have a clinical consult service that advocates, welcomes all of our LGBTQI+ patients to our institution, and I'm happy to provide additional information and provide my contact information at the end of our session. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Haviland. That is really outstanding presentation addressing such key issues that I know there'll be questions on during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thank you. This is an amazing call. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. NFN Scout. Dr. Scout is Executive Director, National LGBTQ Cancer Network, VP of Social Justice, the Torvis Group, Los Angeles, California. And Dr. Scott will be addressing transgender non-conforming people's cancer concerns and challenges for their caregivers and how cancer providers are becoming more welcoming.
Great. Thank you very much.
Now I'll turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Scott.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So as a trans person who's working in the cancer space, it's always practically saddest when I hear from the rest of my trans and gender nonconforming colleagues and community members around what our concerns and experiences are related to cancer. The first thing that we have to understand is, certainly in the United States, but in many other places around the world right now, we're undergoing an incredibly persistent and nonstop level of legislative attacks. We have in our country, the United States, over 250 anti-queer bills that have been introduced in the last 2 weeks alone. And most of these are anti-trans, and so we are very much already feeling as if we are living in an environment where we are absolutely excluded, unwanted, and we have much less safety. When you apply that then with the lens of both seeking our health care, taking care of our health, even understanding that we might survive long enough to get cancer, that's where it really starts to show the differences in what our lived experience is. And we have a huge amount of medical mistrust that has been informed even further by these, has been accelerated by these legislative attacks. But of course, that really affects whether or not we get our screenings in the first place. And even of those of us who are at the position where we do get those screenings and then we get referred on, one of the biggest challenges is we may have a provider that we trust, our healthcare home, as it were, but it doesn't necessarily mean that when they just say something as simple as go get a colonoscopy, that we can then feel as if we're going to be okay going to some new provider, or, you know, colonoscopy shops are usually large groups of providers, things like that, and understand that we're going to be treated with dignity and respect. As Mandy was talking about, a lot of people don't feel like they're necessarily trained in how to do trans care. It's really sad that that's not provided in the medical schools as baseline training. But the truth is, it's not really provided much of anywhere. So those of the provider base that are interested in doing a better job of serving this population are usually reaching out and doing their own additional education and training in order to be successful, which is sad. That said, there are a lot of new resources out there that people can do. Like, just as an example, we have, there are several different training programs around the country. Nanny Shop does one. We also have one called Welcoming Spaces, which is an online enduring training, which people are free to take at any time. You can find it on our website. But just to give you an example, when, you know, when our medical mistrust gets accelerated and we even go to screening, then when you go into cancer treatment, we suddenly are experiencing many providers in a row. And as one of my friends had talked about, every time they go in to get their chemo, they literally have to engage with about 7 or 8 different healthcare people before they get to their actual chemo. And in that instance, the thing that she was highlighting is that 6 to 7 of those 8 people will misgender her before she even gets to her chemo. So that means she's getting what is a little bit even more than a microaggression. She's being told, we do not respect you, 6 to 7 times before they get to even every single chemo treatment. And those kinds of engagements with the healthcare system are part of why we don't trust the provider base and what they're even telling us in the first place, right? Are part of why we are not as satisfied with our cancer care. We're not as satisfied with our quality of life after cancer care if it is continuing. And part of why we really are concerned that once we get data of how many trans people are going through cancer treatment, that we're very likely to find that more of us are not surviving to that endpoint. So there's a myriad of challenges here. That said, like I said, people are becoming more welcoming. I was really heartened to see that National Cancer Institute was putting out funding for NCI-designated cancer centers to become more queer welcoming over the last year and a half. And we have over a dozen of them that have really stepped up initiatives to do a good job throughout their agency. And I will say that there is an absolute hunger for more information on how to treat and how to be more welcoming with trans people very particularly. We went from a situation where probably about 2 years ago we were begging people to pay attention to training and to get training, to the point where now we are getting so many requests we're having a hard time keeping up with them. So I would just like to say that, you know, this is a caring profession, a health profession, and despite the incredible level of challenges, there are so many people in it who are really looking to step up and do a better job. So, you know, if we can get that information disseminated and get people the access to the training that they need, I really suspect that the situation will be changing in the coming years.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dr. Scott. That was really and very helpful, I think, to our participants to hear. And I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman is former founding director, Cancer Support Services, Continuum Cancer Centers of New York, now part of the Mount Sinai Health System, author and researcher in oncology. And Dr. Fleischman will be addressing gay men's and lesbian women's cancer issues, military service, affordable housing, Social Security, and the LGBTQI plus community. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fleischman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, everybody, for signing into the call. Dr. Pratt-Chapman and Dr. Haviland and Dr. Scott have given you a lot of information about cancer screening. I just wanted to underscore one of those points, that especially because of how we're living our lives. Sometimes screening doesn't take place as it should. So, for example, if we're are smoking a lot more than we really need to be able to discuss that with our providers and perhaps be checked for lung cancer earlier. If women with who are concerned and their providers who are concerned about breast cancer may be at more risk because we're having children later or not having children at all, which changes our breast cancer risk. So in addition to the usual factors like family history and exposures to things, there are a whole variety of medical issues and social issues that interact in cancer screening. As was mentioned, anal cancer, penile cancer, cervical cancer, a number of cancers are most likely have something to do with HPV, and those samples need to be taken. And often, most of us are not trained to do, for example, anal pap smears. Those are the kinds of things that we really need to discuss with our providers, and if they can't do that, help with the referral to someone who can. My own experience, as reflected by what has been said before in the transgender community, is that things get extraordinarily complicated because of the interplay between hormonal treatments and whether we have are born with either testicles or ovaries. And often that does need to be done by people who are highly experienced to decide what kind of screening and treatment is necessary. As far as the other topic, in the military, things have come a long way, but not far enough. We certainly have moved from don't ask, don't tell to a military that has leadership that are LGBTQ, including an Air Force commander of the military base in Germany, Jeremiah Grisham, and a retired general, Tammy Smith, who was in the Army and retired from 2021. So it is, I guess, in theory, hope that with leadership at the top, that attitudes and fairness trickle down. That doesn't always happen, but certainly a step in the right direction. As far as affordable housing goes, there is a Fair Housing Act that in the United States goes back to 1968, and sexual orientation is part of the Fair Housing Act, and that's a federal law, but as we know, localities and different states see these rights in a whole different light. So from what I understand and from what I've heard from patients in some states, there still is discrimination in housing, especially in smaller units, which may be exempt, like renting an apartment in a two-family or three-family home. Local laws may not be as protective as the federal law, so just be aware of that. As far as Social Security goes, Social Security, especially for the LGBT community, has been a bit dicey when it comes to receiving survivor's benefits. If a partner or a husband or wife dies, there was little recognition of that before marriage equality, and there is a current retroactive regulations starting in 2021 that people who were partnered before November of 2020 actually can and do qualify for survivor benefits, even though they were not able to legally marry before a certain point. So if any of your patients and clients are in the situation where a partner has died and they need to get survivor benefits, they are being granted. There probably are some extra hoops to jump through, especially in some parts of the country, but things also have come a long way. So I think the good news here is that things have come a long way in screening, but not as far as we hope, and in the military and in the housing fairness and in Social Security, Things are improving, but they're certainly not automatic in every part of the country, even if the laws say that. And we really have to pay attention to what the policies and laws are and reach out to the advocacy groups to get help when it doesn't seem like they're being exercised fairly. I will stop here and turn the call back to Dr. Messner.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. That was excellent. Just a wonderful presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is William Anthony Gorin, and Mr. Gorin is former clinical director and coordinator of men's and LGBTQ plus programs at Cancer Care, psychotherapist, LGBTQ community, somatic experiencing practitioner, cognitive behavioral therapy. And Mr. Gorin will be addressing challenges for the LGBTQ I plus person living with cancer, including practical, financial, emotional, and social concerns, and cancer resources for the LGBTQI plus community. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Mr. Gorin.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm very honored and pleased to be here. And thank you all, the participants who have called into this. I am very moved by the number of participants on this call as relayed to us by Dr. Messner, as well as being with my esteemed colleagues, many of whom I worked with in the past. I do want to bring, there's been so much information provided to you by our previous speakers that's really essential, important, and impactful. But I do want to bring this, some of my comments down to a more personal and anecdotal level. I had the opportunity at Cancer Care to work in to facilitate a gay men's support group, gay men with cancer support group for many, many years. And upon preparing for this talk, I did contact a few of those men and asked them what they considered were the highlights for them as gay men or members of the LGBTQI community and having cancer. What were the predominant themes that were most essential for them? And really, this does speak to the practical, financial, emotional, and social concerns of being a queer person and living with cancer or being affected by cancer as a cancer caregiver. Now, all of us in the queer community have, to some degree or another, really as part of our life goals is to find a community, find a group of people that we connect to, that we feel part of, that we feel safe with, because there are so many queer persons, as Dr. Pratt Chapman has identified, who have been either isolated, separated from, estranged from their of families of origin, their biological families, and thus have sought out the contact and communication with people of their own kind, of their own community, within the queer community. But I wanted to emphasize this in terms of having cancer, because there are so many queer persons living with cancer who cannot turn to their families of origin, who cannot share what they're going through, share their concerns, share the impact of the cancer on their lives, because they have been estranged or completely separated from their families of origin, which also means it's not just their immediate nuclear family, but they've actually been separated from their extended family as well, and in some cases from actual the community that they were raised in. So this great loss of support and potential help really leaves a gap and a hole in terms of being able to live with cancer in terms of financial support, emotional support, and psychological support as well. But taking that situation a bit further, it was noted, and this was brought to my attention by many of the men in my group, that as much as they felt a part of whatever community they belonged to, gay men, lesbians, the trans community, that once they had cancer, once they were diagnosed with cancer, then they felt that there was another episode or another degree of separation or difference from them and their peers in their established communities. So there was actually a kind, almost like a re-traumatization of loss that occurred with the men that reported that they no longer, or they felt slightly separated from their own community of gay men. So I really want to, for those of you who are in the healthcare industry, just bringing that to your attention, and to those of you on the call who are persons with cancer, that this is a common theme, and to really let you know that there are many, many people out there who are experiencing this same feeling or sense of disconnect. So that community, support community, both professional support and personal support is really an important component of learning to live with cancer. I do want to say that some of my colleagues have mentioned some of the progress that has been made recently, both on the federal level and on the state levels, but we are living at a time where in certain parts of the country and in certain states, there is a regression of a sense of community and a sense of less capacity for the LGBTQI community. And this is not only affecting the queer community in those states, but it's also having an impact on those who are living in states where, blue states, where there is more access to LGBTQI safe and competent care. So I just wanted to make note of that, there is a trickle-down impact occurring in the country within our community, the queer community, about what's happening that is really reducing the sense of safety, the sense of feeling that there is access to appropriate and safe health care. I do want to make note as well that there on the federal level that there is some progress being made in terms of the federal government being petitioned to be more inclusive of surveying who are the LGBTQI communities in the United States. And although this is a small step, it is a step in the right direction, and hopefully, again, this will have a broader impact as time goes on. But starting in June 2024, the National Science Foundation will be piloting several versions of LGBTQ AI questions on the estimated 57,000 newly minted PhDs in the United States on their survey required to graduate. So I know this is not related to those with cancer, but I think it gives me hope, and I think that is something that we're all looking for in these very, at times, difficult political times, that there is movement being made, and I think this talk like that Dr. Messner has created for our community is really essential and a really component of health and of hope. So thank you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Gordon. Just a superb presentation and really identifying the current some of the current challenges that that we live in today politically as well. And this is both the United States and internationally as well. So thank you for really, I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Melissa Silicure, and Ms. Silicure will be addressing Cancer Kids Food Programs and Services. She will also be giving you information on how to contact Cancer Care through our Hope Line and also through our website. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Silicure.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And I first just wanted to thank all the panelists and participants here today. This presentation has been very informative and valuable, and very appreciative for all of you being here. And I wanted to just take the time to talk about some of the cancer care services that we do offer. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include case management, counseling and support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. To become connected to any of Cancer Care services, those interested can call Cancer Care's National Hope Line to speak to an oncology social worker. And Cancer Care's toll-free helpline, our Hope Line, that phone number is 1-800-813-4673 or 1-800-813-HOPE. And just to give a brief overview of some of those services, Cancer Care does offer some national supports, including support groups, community programs, publications, and case management services. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register right on our website to join an online support group. And I did want to just highlight two online support groups that we have. First, we do have the LGBTQ plus Young Adults with Cancer support group. This is for patients ages 20 to 39 who self-identify as LGBTQ plus and offers a safe and affirming space. We do also have caregiver support. So we do have the LGBTQ plus support group, Women Caregivers, and that's going to be for caregivers who self-identify as both female and LGBTQ plus and also offers a safe and affirming space. So to register for those, you can go right on our website at cancercare.org. And just to highlight some of the other services we do have case management services that are offered nationally to patients post-treatment, survivors, and caregivers affected by cancer. We offer short-term strength-based approach to case management where the social worker will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Also, on Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, there's also a wide variety of reading materials and information related to topics pertaining to cancer. This includes recorded Connect Education workshops, Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, publications on different topics, as well as stories of help and hope, and any cancer resources. So I'm looking forward to answering any questions in the Q&A. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Silicure. An excellent presentation and a wonderful resource for everybody on the call as well. And now on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Regina to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Regina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only, and you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So I have a question, I guess, to Mandy Pratt Chapman to start. I would love more information on how to access those trainings.
We have a training called TEAM, Together Equitable, Accessible, Meaningful, and you can access that at the GW Learning Management System site. You can go to gwcconlineacademy.org, and we house there a number of trainings to support people in a number of cancer control topics, including our TEAM training that I just mentioned, which covers 5 hours of content with physician and nurse CE We cover kind of social determinants of health and broad health disparities across a range of lived experiences with a focused spotlight on Black, Latino, and queer disparities, as well as interpersonal and system-level strategies for change. We also have additional content that is focused specifically on LGBTQ communities, and I haven't yet had the bandwidth to get that up and going. It's Scout knows it's been on my list for a very long time, but I am always happy to collaborate and share if someone needs a particular deep dive into a particular topic and wants to contact me. I'm happy to share slides and then disseminate when we have that training up and running. Our training covers more of the kind of clinical care considerations, whereas the LGBT network, their welcoming spaces training is excellent for also a high-level look at affirming environment. So I would definitely recommend the one that Scout mentioned, available on his site, as well as the trainings we have on our site at GW. We also have a patient navigation training, communications, policy systems change, and cancer survivorship trainings there with a variety of CE depending on your discipline. I hope that's helpful.
Excellent. Others want to add anything to that? Other speakers want to add any other trainings? Okay, excellent. Thank you, Dr. Pratt Chapman, for addressing this so thoroughly. I have a question from question for Dr. Scout. What was the virtual online training you discussed during your presentation to help me learn how to provide care to patients who identify as LGBTQI+?
It's called Welcoming Spaces. It is a free online enduring training. There are 5 modules that are available for anybody in the cancer or even just the health field, including front desk all the way up to specialist providers. And then the last 3 modules are specific to providers who are providing trans gyn-onc care specifically. We did with Society for Gynecologic Oncology, and you can absolutely get it, Welcoming Spaces, at our website, which is National LGBT Cancer Network. Just Google that and you'll get to us and you can get to the training.
Excellent. And actually, people are asking if they're getting CEs available, and they are available for for dietitians and for social workers. We have CEs available.
Thank you very much. A very good workshop. As a single older gay male and cancer survivor, what services are available for a person in my situation to get a caregiver if and when I need one? And also, what about assisted living situations for older LGBTQI individuals? What's available in assisted living situations, and how do they treat the gay person in a general assisted living situation?
Excellent question, Neil. Thank you. Dr. Haviland, do you want to address that question?
Somewhat of an overview. I think part of the problem is that it depends regionally where you are. For example, I am in New York City. We do have a select number of resources for assisted living. So we're quite lucky in that sense. That does not exist everywhere. There are some communities, retirement type communities within at least the United States that I'm aware of that can be affirming for LGBTQI+ people. I think it's very difficult, and I think we need to continue to advocate and we need to provide as we all age, we need to provide safe, welcoming care. We do know from, you know, anecdotal work and also studies in the literature that there is real a lack of environment for us as we grow older. So I don't know if, Scout, if you have any other resources, but I think it's something that we really need to prioritize for us.
And just to add on, I would love to be able to say we have plenty of resources, but that's really not the truth. You know, we're a pretty small organization that's growing quickly, and we prioritize trying to provide some social support resources for people. So we do have support groups that meet 3 times a week that are open and available to anybody virtually. But beyond that, we're really kind of dependent upon a lot of the existing cancer organizations with all of that infrastructure to provide resources that are open and welcoming to us. More are trying to do that these days, but it doesn't mean that we have the level of tailored resources we need by any measure of any yardstick. So we're hustling fast to try and get more of these things put into place, but there is absolutely too little right now.
And Mr. Gordon, do you want to comment on SAGE, or do you want to comment on
that? Yes, thank you, Dr. Messner. I would recommend that Dr. Haviland and Dr. Scout and Dr. Pratt-Chapman, all of these organizations are terrific organizations to start if you're in the place or in the position, whether you're a professional or whether you're a person with cancer or a cancer caregiver. These are wonderful places to start to, including cancer care, to begin building your network of resources and support. In addressing the older queer population, I would recommend contacting SAGE, excuse me, which is an organization that is dedicated to the senior LGBTQI population. They are addressing the needs of those who are in the position for independent or assisted living. And I think that would be an important adjunct to your list of resources. I do know that just recently I was interviewing a director at one of a national independent assisted living organizations that is across the United States, and I asked him specifically, how does your company broadly nationally address the issues of the LGBTQI population who needs independent or assisted living? And interestingly and fascinatingly enough, they said, we are absolutely open to addressing those needs. We welcome individuals and couples into our independent and assisted living communities. So I think there's movement in the right direction for this, and SAGE, S-A-G-E, would be an important place to start that search.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. So here's a question, and this question I'm going to give to Dr. Fleischman. As someone who doesn't fall under the LGBTQ plus umbrella, how do you suggest I educate myself so I'm better able to advocate for the best care for members of the community?
Good question. I think when all of us have been speaking about the attitudes and care of the facilities and the providers for people of all groups, especially for the LGBTQI community. So, for example, we are filling out forms usually for a first visit, or a staff member helps us ask us a lot of questions and enters the information on the computer. Things like name, and then who's your emergency contact, how they're related, if it's a husband or a wife, or friends, those kinds of things really need to be specified, and the facility needs to be comfortable in that. And facilities that are comfortable then have that kind of attention to equality all the way through the care. Especially when one of the previous speakers mentioned about advanced directives and healthcare proxies, extremely sensitive issue. When your healthcare agent is same gender, it's really important that that be addressed. That often comes up in emergency situations, either in an emergency room or an intensive care unit. And again, being in a place where there's a certain level of comfort and training really makes a difference.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to add to that? Okay.
I'll just say that there, I know that Cancer Care is going to be sending out some resources to participants. We do have a tip sheet for provider strategies in terms of communicating with LGBTQI patients, an intake form that you can adapt, modify, however you'd like to get you started in terms of inclusive questions. I know that the LGBT Cancer Network has materials that they can share, and then, of course, the trainings that we mentioned, the Welcome Spaces training and the GW team trainings are great. We also have an archive training specific to gay and trans prostate patient challenges for cancer survivors that's also available on our GWCCOnlineAcademy.org site. So hopefully those are resources that can help get you started. The Fenway Institute also has many videos. If there are topics in particular that you're interested in for the person who asked how to learn more. So yeah, and I think everybody on this call and in the field is pretty are pretty strong advocates and want to collaborate, so reach out if you have a specific question.
And just as another thing to add on, we have a toolkit coming out of the National LGBT Cancer Network in probably the next 2 months around offices interested in being more welcoming. So we're kind of assembling that information from a lot of different places so you can step through it.
Oh, excellent. So what we'll do is we are sending out resources to all of you. We can include resources, I think, that Dr. Haviland mentioned that you have. We can include those if you wish to share them. We can just send out, you know, whatever anyone has. We can include that in the SurveyMonkey, because SurveyMonkey is an evaluation of the program, but it also allows us to add resources for all of you so we can, perhaps after the program we can decide all the resources that we want to put together and send so everybody has resources at their fingertips in addition to what you wrote down listening today, if that would make sense to everybody, to do, it would be helpful to them, to everybody. So this is a question for, I think, Dr. Haviland. Can a panelist share resources that can assist a COE team with outreach to the LGBTQI+ community, especially as it relates to cervical cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer? We often struggle with engagement for fear of disrespecting someone. Could you begin by answering that question or addressing it?
I'm just slightly unclear. What the resources to the CO, what is the COE team, maybe?
I don't know what the COE team is, so it's an online question.
I'm assuming that's probably
community outreach engagement.
Engagement,
yeah.
Yes.
Per
part of every cancer center, yeah.
Okay.
Resources for the community outreach. I mean, I'm going to also probably defer to the, I primarily practice in an inpatient academic setting, and we do partner with LP, with our community partnerships. The Scout's an excellent resource in that way and has resources as well, so I would defer to Scout, but I will say that in terms of speaking to and talking to engagement of providers and garnering engagement, that's always a very difficult topic, and I think it's important to remember that it's not just one training. We should have repeated integration of these teachings into regular sessions. So I think there's ongoing work that needs to be done. I think it's an intro to what are basic terminology for many people, followed by what are disparities, and then what are the specific risks that we are and the barriers to care that we encounter in our LGBTQI+ populations, and then we can go into teaching the clinical care for our patient populations.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in there too. I'm Associate Director for Community Outreach Engagement and Equity at GW, and COE groups are tasked with conducting outreach directly to community members, including coordinating evidence-based screenings and risk reduction programs, navigating people into and through care, and then also making sure our research is responsive to what communities prioritize and need. So one strategy I would say, you know, we have learned a lot in terms of community-based participatory research, and I think that the outreach principles apply, you know, across the board in terms of regardless of which population you're trying to reach, having folks on your team that are from the community that you're trying to serve, having representation and input and ongoing thought leadership from the community that you want to serve. One thing that we did this year that I'm really proud of is that we recruited regular people from our catchment area across our catchment area, and we trained them in a 100-hour community health worker training and are now deploying those individuals as our outreach, our paid outreach network. And that included a focus on LGBTQ populations, but also African-American, African immigrant, and Latino because of the area that I am responsible for in the D.C. area. But it's a model that I'm pretty proud of. So far, it's been a little bit challenging, but I think, you know, how identifying people from the community to reach other people in the community is the way to go.
Excellent. Thank you. And did someone else want to respond as well?
On that point, I would kind of say that it's harder to say that there's a bunch of standard things that you can put out. I do always suggest you get local community advisors, and then you can absolutely call places like us. Feel free to reach out to me, scout@cancer-network.org. And we, you know, have been working with a lot of NCI cancer centers, and so we've got a lot of lessons learned, which we're going to be distilling into this toolkit. But oftentimes, it's hard to take things right off the shelf because in order to do a good job of this, you have to have an advisory board or local employees who are part of the community continuing to advise you.
Excellent. Wow. Fantastic. This is, I have to say, we could go on all afternoon, but I realize we have all kind of a hard stop. But I do want to thank our speakers. I want to thank our participants. I'm going to ask each of our speakers if you would just provide a takeaway, which would just be like a minute takeaway that you'd like the participants to take away with them. So I'm going to start with, we'll go in the order that you presented. So Mandy Pratt Chapman, if you'd like to go first and just provide a takeaway for our participants.
Sure. I would say it sounds like that there are people from a lot of walks of life that are affected by cancer, including providers on this call. So I would say for key takeaway, just ongoing reflection and learning and openness to learning more about the experiences that might be different from what you have experienced in order to provide excellent support to cancer patients and families, including queer communities, would be what I would most want you to take away.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Kelly Haviland?
Hi. Yeah, I think understanding that care, cancer care for LGBTQI plus populations is extremely complex and doesn't just begin with, or doesn't just encompass asking a question about an identity or who a person is. It enters into policy, institutional arenas, as well as clinical care of our LGBTQI populations. And to understand the complexities and the intersectionalities that occur in care for our LGBTQI plus population.
Thank you. And Dr. Nathan Scout?
I would really say that, as one person had brought up, we are actually really dependent upon the 350 people on this call to change this disparity gap and get rid of it. If you wait for the experts to do it, it will take decades. So we really need you. You don't have to be an expert by any means. What you have to do is be committed to the idea that we need to change our practices. One size fits all work does not work for this or many other underrepresented and underserved overlapping communities. So if you are in any kind of a place where you engage with the cancer care stream or the healthcare stream, and you're not seeing tailored activities for the queer communities, ask why not, and ask what can happen in order to change that, because that's really what we need in order to eliminate the disparity gap. It's also how it's really happening right now. Those champions.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Fleischman?
Sure. And dealing with our providers, we hope that everybody can ask and can tell about their sexual practices and their sexual orientation, their gender orientation. And if you feel that your providers just aren't sympathetic or can't handle it, speak with someone in the larger facilities, in the hospitals and the larger medical centers. There are patient advocates. In smaller offices, there is generally an office manager or someone beyond the individual provider who can help, and then try to get a referral to one of the larger centers that is close to you that can that treats cancer as an accredited cancer center, and they often have people who can help.
Excellent, thank you. And Mr. Gorin?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I do have a takeaway, which is to say that wherever you are in this country or even our international participants, that there is assistance, there is support out there. You may have to spend some time searching for that, but just the representations of my esteemed colleagues who are on this call, they all represent important and necessary organizations that is bringing this journey forward. And for someone like myself, who has been doing this work going back some 20 years, it provides me great pleasure to hear how far we have come, yet we have so much further to go. But as Dr. Stout said, it just takes one person to make large changes, and that is represented by Dr. John Freeman from Columbia University, who is actually the mover and shaker to get the National Science Foundation to begin to survey the LGBTQI population in those newly minted PhDs. That's a beginning. It's a first step, and there are many steps afterwards.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. And Ms. Salicura.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I just would like to say that navigating a cancer diagnosis is challenging and overwhelming, and especially for vulnerable populations like the LGBTQI+. So just seeking like support and guidance, kind of echoing some of the other panelists, just knowing that there are networks and formal agencies that can provide that level of support. So just remembering you're not alone.
Thank you. And I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I also want to thank our participants. I think, as Dr. Scott said, it's all of you who actually can now spread the word about what we discussed today more and more, asking questions, learning more. Now, we will be providing all of you with the resources. So we will develop a resource, as many resources as we can send to you in that SurveyMonkey evaluation, which is really an evaluation of the program, but will also include, all the resources. And some of the speakers, I think, are also offered to provide their email addresses as well. So we will do that as well. But I do want to comment on the fact that we weren't able to take everyone's question. So I just want to say something about that. For those of you who asked a question, for those of you who have a question yet to ask, are in queue. And for those of you who are thinking of a question, please take all of your questions, so even the ones that asked a question, please take everything back to your treating healthcare team. They technically know you the best. They have access to your chart. And you've learned something from today's program, we hope. And so therefore, you will be asking that question in a more informed way. You also have additional resources that we will be providing that you can keep asking your questions. And keep asking questions until you get the answers that you need. That's really most important. We don't really want, I think, as Ms. Leekor said, we don't want anyone to feel you're alone in coping with cancer with coping with being part of the LGBTQI plus community. We want you to know that you're now part of a community of support. We are here to help you. So please, please take care. You will be getting resources that will hopefully be useful to you, both for those wanting training and for those of you who actually want to get resources for your care. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. We will be doing other programs like this in the future, so stay tuned. And thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.